So the significance of this is that in Ferguson and in many of the towns, because I want to stress that Ferguson was the town that got the most attention, but there's a lot of even worse violators than Ferguson in North St. Louis County in terms of the targeting of young black males and the and a very harsh municipal court system. In Ferguson, this is significant because Ferguson had one of the highest percentages of anywhere in the country of the number of people living in the town having arrest warrants on them. And once people get locked up, often, even if they're only locked up for a week, they'll lose a job.
We have 10 seconds.
And this is very significant because it will give tons of young people an opportunity to make their way in the world without a criminal background.
I want to thank you very much, Jeff, for joining us. The book is fascinating. It's called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. Jeff Smith is a former Missouri state senator, now professor at New School here in New York. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Tuesday evening news, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lights, Camera, Action, making video easy on Wednesday, September 2nd, 6 p.m. at Portland Community Media. Lights, Camera, Action, a collaboration between PDX Tech for Good and Portland Community Media. This seminar will show you how to make high-quality video for outreach and fundraising using the cutting-edge technology available at Portland Community Media. Again, that's Lights, Camera, Action, making video easy on Wednesday, September 2nd, 6 p.m. at Portland Community Media, 2766 Northeast MLK Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Who is Gil Scott-Heron as part of the We Real Cool Jazz Series at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, September 17th at 7 p.m. Who is Gil Scott-Heron is a portrait seen through the eyes of those who love Gil, his friends, his family, and the musicians he played with. All attending the theatrical screenings receive a download of Scott-Heron's last record, Nothing New. Again, that's Who is Gil Scott-Heron, Thursday, September 17th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Rockets and moonshots.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, walrus herd of Obama's arrival.
Mayor and commissioner hold Uber secret meeting.
Wild horses couldn't drag away protesters sitting in opposition to a federal roundup of Oregon's wild Mustangs. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 1st, 2015. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. A city auditor has issued a warning to Mayor Charlie Hales and Commissioner Steve Novick for violating code by failing to properly disclose a meeting with Uber lobbyists in December. City code requires elected officials to list all activities related to official business on their public calendar. The meeting happened at the home of a professional lobbyist, Mark Weiner. The Uber-employed lobbyist has also worked as a consultant on both Hales and Novick's election campaigns.
Lightning caused one of the most dangerous fires in Oregon. Volunteers were summoned after fire officials had decided the threat had subsided. Volunteers fought the wildfire in Canyon Creek. They arrived from miles around and all walks of life. During major fires, such as Canyon Creek, professional teams move in to manage the fire. When homes are threatened, as they were near John Day, the Conflagration Act allows State Fire Marshal Jim Walker to order in help from around the state. The task forces of local engines have one job, to protect homes. They leave the fire itself to wildland crews. Though the Canyon Creek fire continues to burn, fire officials already are assessing what spared homes on Pine Creek. They cite the volunteers' earlier preparation to set in place sprinklers and pumps and a relatively new program called FireWise. Under FireWise, neighbors band together to help each other make their homes and neighborhood more fire-resistant. FireWise is run by and for the community.
College students today are more likely to use marijuana daily, or near daily, than they are to use tobacco products daily. That's one of the findings in a report issued recently by the Monitoring the Future Project at the University of Michigan. The opposite is true when all young adults, defined as between the ages of 19 and 28, are looked at as a whole. Nearly 6% of college students report daily marijuana use, while just less than 7% of all young adults report daily use. Daily tobacco use, in any amount, is reported by just over 5% of college students, but among all young adults, that figure jumps to nearly 11%.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos, coming to you from an Amtrak train. Today I'm going to share some extraordinary news about what's happening in Colorado, where the community rights movement has launched its first ever statewide ballot initiative campaign to amend their state constitution. I'm going to tell you the story through the words of Simon Davis Cohen, a wonderful New York City-based journalist who's been doing a lot of reporting on our movement over the past few years. On August 19, he wrote a piece called In Colorado, a Revolutionary New Coalition Stands for Community Rights. Here's an excerpt. In Colorado, local governments cannot raise the minimum wage, pass rent control laws, or ban fracking. A system of state preemption, a favorite tool of the fossil fuel industry, stands in their way. Local activists have long been outspoken about this legal barrier to keeping fossil fuels in the ground. Now a coalition embodying a range of economic and environmental justice fights is coming together to directly challenge the basis for state preemption. On August 17, a statewide initiative was launched by Coloradans for Community Rights to do just that. It may be the first time that anti-extraction and workers' rights movements have allied behind a concrete political tactic in modern U.S. history. The Colorado Community Rights Amendment, which needs some 99,000 signatures to qualify for the 2016 ballot, disrupts preemption by granting local governments a constitutional right to raise state standards, empowering them to boost the minimum wage, bolster environmental protections, and strengthen tenants' rights, for example. It would recognize the authority of local governments to enact local laws that protect health, safety, and welfare by recognizing or establishing rights of natural persons, their local communities, and nature. Crucially, the proposed amendment also elevates local lawmaking above competing rights, powers, privileges, immunities, or duties of corporations. This means that if a local law conflicts with a corporation's constitutional right, the local law would prevail, in direct contradiction to our current legal structure, which allows corporations to sue local, state, and federal governments that restrict property rights. The amendment doesn't read like a manifesto, but it could be revolutionary. The initiative is part of a multi-state community rights movement working to introduce the right to local self-government and to elevate that right above corporate legal privileges and the state governments that act to protect them. The movement's work takes legal counsel from the Pennsylvania-based Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. In Colorado, the Community Rights Amendment would also undermine the bedrock private law exception, which has historically limited local government's authority to regulate private relationships between employer and employee or landlord and tenant, for example. It's this exception that provides the ideological basis for preventing cities from raising the minimum wage or passing sick leave ordinances. Simon Davis Cohen continues his article with an interview with Andrea Merida of 15 Now Colorado, a group supporting the effort to qualify the initiative for the 2016 ballot and fighting to raise the state minimum wage. Andrea explains why a group focusing on a living wage as a human right would choose to partner with a statewide community rights campaign challenging state preemption. Here's a brief excerpt of Andrea's thoughts. Rents in the Denver metro area are skyrocketing, and ultimately local governments also need the flexibility to consider further actions such as rent control and breaking up utility monopolies to help workers make ends meet. If we don't strengthen local rights now, we will be back at the ballot box again soon because the cost of living could quickly outpace any minimum wage increase. 15 Now Colorado believes that it's time to recalibrate the way we see ourselves in society. Government exists to serve the interests of workers first, but unfortunately this is not the reality. Too often the requirements of excess profit trump the right to live in dignity, and by using our state constitution to change that paradigm, we believe we can finally create a Colorado that serves everyone. Again, I've been reading excerpts from an article written by Simon Davis Cohen, a wonderful writer covering our community rights movement. You can read more of his stories at readthedirt.org. Here in Oregon, as in many other states, we also have serious problems with state preemption laws that violate our rights. Portlanders are currently trying to get the local government to raise the minimum wage, as Seattle did recently, but they're barred from doing so because the restaurant lobby convinced the state legislature to pass a minimum wage preemption law in 2001. The Oregon Home Builders Association is responsible for the state legislature passing an inclusionary zoning preemption ban in the late 1990s that would have prevented gentrification. And local rent control lawmaking is also preempted by the state. Perhaps it's time here in Oregon for our living wage and tenants' rights campaigns to pay closer attention to the Colorado Community Rights Amendment that would end this state preemption outrage. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my twice monthly updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has reported daily sightings of walruses near the Shell oil drilling flotilla in the Arctic. So far, at least 700 of the protected sea mammals have been reported within the oil lease authorized by President Obama. Over the past week, thousands of walruses have been hauling themselves onto dry land as their natural habitat, massive ice sheets in the Chukchi Sea, melt away in the warming climate. No word on if the walruses are deliberately timing their haul out to coincide with President Obama's visit to Alaska.
On Monday, a group of activists staged a sit-in at Governor Kate Brown's office in opposition to the rounding up of wild horses by the Bureau of Land Management. The BLM is set to round up more than 150 horses in the Kiger and Rydell horse management areas, leaving only 84 in the wild. Their effort is to control color and characteristics of horses in those regions. The activists in opposition to the horse grab say this reduction in population will thin the inheritance bloodline, which runs back to Spanish settlers in the 17th century. The horses are to be rounded up this week and put up for adoption October 3rd. The Bureau of Land Management is a federal agency, and the governor's office may not affect its action. Last year, Vince Patton of OPB found that horses in captivity now outnumber those in the wild. At a cost of $5.50 per horse per day, the annual cost of corralling almost 50,000 horses in this country equals $46 million annually. Nearly 40,000 Mustangs roam free.
Taking advantage of coastal winds, wind power generators will be able to take a greater role in supplying this nation's energy needs. In Europe already, offshore wind farms across 10 countries are generating enough electricity to power almost 5 million households. In the U.S., the Department of Energy is funding research nationwide to develop and deploy offshore wind technologies. In Oregon, Governor Kate Brown has taken another step towards procuring as much as $47 million in federal grants for an offshore wind project. Wind Float Pacific Offshore Wind Advisory Committee was formed to work with the company Principal Power on a proposal to build a wind demonstration project off the coast of Coos Bay. The Wind Float Pacific project has the potential to simultaneously work toward creating new energy solutions for the nation while creating hundreds of new jobs across multiple sectors here at home, Brown said. The project would generate 30 megawatts of power, enough to power the equivalent of 7,000 homes. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory estimates that the West Coast could eventually host 8 gigawatts of offshore wind generation and support 25,000 plus jobs. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview and KBOO News in Depth. This will be followed by Out Loud at 6, or another program. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, a chance of showers and lows around 57. Tomorrow, a 50% chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a high near 71. NOAA notes that the first day of meteorological fall marked by above normal temperatures across much of the United States. Above normal temperatures are forecast across much of the contiguous United States on Tuesday and in some cases will be as much as 10 to 15 degrees above average for this time of year. Afternoon highs could reach 90 or higher from the Great Plains to the Eastern Seaboard. Today in history, in 1807, Aaron Burr is arrested in Mississippi for complicity in a plot to establish a southern empire in Louisiana and Mexico. In 1939, Germany invades Poland, beginning World War II in Europe. The quote of the day is from Thomas Edison. "We are like tenant farmers chopping down the fence around our house for fuel when we should be using nature's inexhaustible sources of energy, sun, wind, and tide. I'd put my money on the sun and solar energy. What a source of power. I hope we don't have to wait until oil and coal run out before we tackle that."
It's 5:17. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Donnie Trump is said to be the biggest thing in American politics these days. Of course, that's mostly being said by him, then repeated ad nauseum by media gone gaga over his summer of self-worship. In essence, Trump is nothing but a figment of his own imagination, and his presidential candidacy is even less substantial than a figment. As columnist Maureen Dowd notes, his campaign is like a, quote, runaway Macy's Thanksgiving Day balloon. In fact, that image pretty well sums up the Donald. A huge plastic cartoonish balloon bloated with gaseous ego and floating precariously above us. The danger of Donnie, however, is not that he'll get elected, but that his racist, nativist, xenophobic nonsense is giving permission for others to spout the same ugliness in public, and for other candidates to adopt some of his ugliest policies. For instance, by mindlessly and repeatedly asserting that immigrants from Mexico are rapists and murderers, The narcissistic TV celebrity has pushed this dehumanizing and dangerous stereotype from the darkest fringe of paranoid politics directly into the Republican race for president. Moreover, Trump has turned this vile bias into a vile proposal to revoke, quote, birthright citizenship, which is our Constitution's guarantee that children born here are citizens. This smug son of privilege wants to take that basic right away from the U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants. Such rank political exploitation of children should be scorned and rejected as un-American, but instead, it's being embraced, not only by far-out GOP wannabes like Ted Cruz and Bobby Jindal, but also by some supposedly serious candidates, including Scott Walker and even Jeb Bush. This is Jim Hightower saying, Trump seems proud to be a buffoon, but his pusillanimous copycat rivals clearly have no pride at all. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This weekend, a most rare meteorological event took place. Three Category 4 hurricanes emerged in the Pacific Ocean at once. Two have since weakened to Category 3. This is the first time three major hurricanes have occurred in this region of the ocean. Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Fred has been the first since 1892 to touch down in the islands of the Republic of Cabo Verde, off the west coast of Africa. AP reports the storm caused flooding, some power outages, and uprooted trees, but that no major damage was noted. Days earlier, Tropical Storm Erica blew through the Caribbean, ravishing the island of Dominica, taking several lives. Already, scientists have characterized this coming El Niño season with increased tropical storm activity. Vast drought across the United States and abroad has been attributed to climate change as a result of increased carbon in the atmosphere. Rising global temperatures will surely continue to manifest extreme weather. Ahead of the 21st United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Paris, the need for global climate action has grown precipitous.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A dozen people in Chicago are entering day 16 of a hunger strike to save Diet Public School. They worked for years on a proposal to transform the school into one that meets community needs, but say the Chicago Public Schools and Mayor Rahm Emanuel are ignoring them. G2 Brown is one of the Diet Dozen hunger strikers.
We are in this hunger strike because we've been rendered voiceless by Chicago Public Schools and the Mayor Rahm Emanuel. There's enough money in this country. There's enough money in the education system to make sure that every child is given the opportunity to stand on their parents' shoulders. And that's what we're fighting for. And if people want to help, they can go to Twitter, use the hashtag #FightForDiet. You can call Mayor Rahm Emanuel at 312-744-3300. Tell him that the nation is watching him and that you support the community that's hunger striking for Walter Diet Global Leadership and Green Technology High School. Tell him to end the hunger strike by giving that school to the community now.
On Monday, clergy called the moral question about Mayor Emanuel's refusal to entertain the Diet proposals and end the hunger strike. Reverend Robert Jones, pastor of Mount Carmel Baptist Church in Chicago, is one of the hunger strikers.
There were a number of clergy from different faiths that came together and called on the mayor to do the right thing for the community. There are people from all other communities that are coming out. There are people from all over that are really supporting us on social media. We have a tremendous community support for what we want to do.
Both Brown and Reverend Jones say they are tired of the double standard applied to communities of color and to predominantly white middle-class communities by Chicago Public Schools and the mayor, and they want an elected school board to make sure people of color in Chicago are no longer disenfranchised when it comes to education. SEIU says Fort Lauderdale, Florida airport workers fighting for living wages will rally Tuesday at the Broward County Commission. The union says the workers will protest labor violations by airline contractors. Fort Lauderdale airport workers have struggled for more than 2 years trying to organize for living wages and better treatment on the job. SEIU says the workers have been met with intimidation and bullying. The airport service workers make an average of $8.14 an hour, according to SEIU, and are excluded from Broward County's living wage ordinance.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Police in DeKalb County, Georgia, wounded a homeowner and killed his dog when they responded to a report of a possible break-in last night. Three officers responded to a 911 call, but arrived at the wrong address. They checked the house and found the back door was unlocked, which they thought was suspicious. The police entered the house and encountered a dog in the kitchen. Two officers fired their weapons and killed the dog. The homeowner then entered the kitchen to see what was going on, and the police shot him in the leg. One of the officers got shot in the hip. A preliminary report of the incident by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation shows the police officer was shot by another cop. No names have yet been released. The homeowner was taken to the hospital, treated, and released. The officer who was shot had to undergo surgery and is reported to be in serious but stable condition. The police involved in the incident have been placed on administrative leave pending a full investigation.
In Tampa, Florida, a young mom was dropping her kids off at school when she was attacked by a cop. The cop says he was concerned about a tinted license plate cover obscuring the plate. Only 34 seconds went by before she was brutally slammed face first onto the ground. The story happened last November and has reemerged since her lawyer finally got a hold of the cop's dash cam video. The cops had denied that there was any such video. In fact, the cop who filed the report claimed there was none. According to Matt Agorist, writing in Alternet, if you watch the video, it becomes quite apparent as to why they would have claimed it didn't exist. Tinted license plates covers can be purchased in auto parts stores all over the state. And despite the cop's claim that the license plate was obscured, it can be easily seen and read in the grainy video.
A San Antonio TV station has video showing police shooting a man with his hands in the air. Police responding to a domestic disturbance call were trying to detain 41-year-old Gilbert Flores and had used so-called less lethal weapons. Police claim he was resisting arrest, but the video shows that Flores had given up and had raised his hands over his head when he was gunned down. The video was taken by a bystander, and the cops did not know there was a video when they filed the report. After the video was released to the public, the Bexar County Sheriff's Office wrote on Facebook that the release of the video had resulted in threats to the officers. He posted the station's phone number and urged people to let the local media know this sort of sensational behavior doesn't fly in Bexar County. The two officers involved have been placed on administrative leave.
Taser-firing drones are now legal in North Dakota. Police will now be free to fire less lethal weapons from the air. This category includes such things as tear gas, mace, rubber bullets, beanbags, sound cannons, and tasers. The new law started out as a requirement for police to get search warrants to use drones to search for criminal evidence. In that version, all manner of weaponry was banned. However, it was amended to allow less lethal weapons. This is the first state in the union to have such a law. The amendment was added by lobbyists for the growing drone industry in North Dakota. Even though classified by authorities as less than lethal weapons, that term is a misnomer. To wit, 39 people have been killed in 2015 so far.
U.S. immigration authorities have until October 23rd to release minors held in immigration detention facilities, according to a federal judge's order. U.S. District Court Judge Dolly G. of California ruled detaining minors in jail-like settings violates a longstanding, legally binding agreement, the 1997 Flores Settlement. Immigration authorities argued the family detention policy serves as a deterrent. Legal experts say it's likely hundreds will be in limbo as the case winds through the courts. Life inside one of the facilities opened expressly to detain immigrant mothers with their children is the focus of a nationwide art collaboration called Visions from the Inside. The The collaborative was organized through Culture Strike and was inspired by letters penned by detained women and children inside a family detention facility in Carnes County, Texas. From Free Speech Radio News, Sadia Malik has more.
At his quiet East Oakland, California cottage, 35-year-old Robert Trujillo works as an artist and illustrator. He's one of 15 artists selected by the San Francisco Bay Area-based Culture Strike for Visions from the Inside, a collaboration in which illustrators visually interpret firsthand accounts related in letters written by women and children held at a family detention center in South Texas. Trujillo adapted one such letter written by a 10-year-old named Miguel. The piece portrays details from the boy's description of daily life in the detention center and includes a large man with an angry face on the front of his head and a happy face on the back. The figure is hunched over and pointing at two children.
The boy, when he wrote the letter, he talked about how the guards that they work with can be kind of two-faced and how some of them will be, you know, very kind, you know, when the media is around or when they feel like it, they'll be a little bit kind. But when it comes to other things, like, they'll just turn very quickly and be very mean to them.
Trujillo was invited to participate in the Visions from the Inside collaboration by Culture Strike's artist projects manager, Julio Salgado, a 31-year-old undocumented artist who also contributed a piece to the series. Salgado's illustration shows a mother and son huddled inside an ice cube. He explains that the mother who wrote the letter that inspired the piece said she'd been kept for 7 days in a frigid detention cell, a practice that immigrant detainees say is not uncommon.
You know, and it's called hieleras because, or icebox, because it gets really cold. And a lot of the times they do this on purpose, immigration does this on purpose, so that people get desperate and then sign detention. They get the self-deportation releases, and you know, and you sign the papers and that's it without seeing a judge or anything. And so the letter mentioned, and I'm not gonna forget this, like, it mentions, like, the mom mentioning how she celebrated her kid's first birthday inside of a detention center. And so I put that, you know, I made this, like, mom and this kid's, like, hugging each other. And there's, like, a birthday cake with the number one.
Salgado says the concept behind Visions from the Inside stemmed from a conversation he had with a detainee during a visit to the Eloy Detention Center in Arizona earlier this year, organized by Mariposas Sin Fronteras, an advocacy group for undocumented LGBTQ in detention.
And so I noticed, you know, he had writing, you know, he had pieces of paper, and so I asked him about the letter writing. So I'm like, how, you know, how important is for you letter writing? And he was just like, it's the only way that I can tell my own story. And it's the only way that I can get in touch with organizations like Mariposas Sin Fronteras. And we don't, because people don't write letters anymore. We don't. We live in the world of email and texting. And so you don't realize how something so basic to a lot of us, you know, to, like, write a letter, how crucial it is for people in detention centers to communicate with the outside world.
The letters that inspired Visions from the Inside are part of a digital archive provided by the End Family Detention Network. Detention capacity for holding mothers with children has expanded exponentially since the summer of 2014, during a spike in apprehensions of unaccompanied minors and of women with children along the border with Mexico. Most of those now in family detention are from Central America and are awaiting the outcomes of asylum claims. The detention center in Carnes County, Texas, is one of two large for-profit facilities in South Texas, open since 2014 specifically to detain immigrant women with children. But Stephen Kang, Equal Justice Rights Fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrants' Rights Project, says there are viable alternatives to detention.
The government basically made the argument that we need to be able to use these fast-track deportation procedures to deport women and children. And we really question whether that's actually true. It can instead just refer these women and children, most of whom have quite valid and strong asylum claims, and just refer them to regular removal proceedings before an immigration judge where they're going to get a full and fair chance to present their claim. And that would also not require them to be detained at these facilities where these women and children are clearly suffering.
A federal judge in California recently ruled that the detention of immigrant children in jail-like facilities is unlawful and in violation of a longstanding agreement known as the Flores Settlement, and has given the Obama administration until October 23rd to release the minors. What will come after detention, or whether the mothers will be released with their children, remains to be seen. Through their work, artists behind Visions from the Inside hope to provide a glimpse of how women and children experience living in a prison-like setting in a way that people on the outside can understand. Asadia Malik, FSRN, Oakland.
Last Friday, Nina Hall swam 5 kilometers across a stretch of the Mediterranean between Turkey and the small Greek island, in an act of solidarity with the thousands of fleeing refugees. In what is being called the worst refugee crisis since World War II, many thousands of migrants leaving their homes in Africa have taken to the sea on shifty rigs under harsh policing by European authorities. Many have fallen and thousands have lost their lives in an effort to escape their respective warring nations toward safe harbor in Europe. Nina Hall wrote her story in The Guardian, noting refugees are being tear-gassed in Macedonia, blocked by razor wire on the Hungarian border. She is concerned that many European governments are responding with force to people who have risked everything for the sake of survival. She says Europe needs workers, and leaders should turn this crisis into an opportunity to include new skills and let the economy positively grow with migration. European governments are legally obliged to assist refugees, according to the 1951 Refugee Convention and by historical record.
Over 120,000 people gathered last Sunday to protest Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's proposal for a bill to expand the military's role in external relations. The rally, massive as it was only one of more than 300 protests staged in Japan over the weekend to say no to what the demonstrators call a violation of the Constitution. Over the past week, demonstrations have taken place nightly around the National Diet Building in Tokyo, protesting the Abe government's attempt to push through legislation that opens the door for Japan to participate in collective self-defense with its allies, and particularly with the United States. In addition to public protest, according to a Reuters poll, 63% of Japanese businesses oppose the government's priority of security matters over economic issues. The bill, which has already passed the lower house of parliament, would move Japan very far away from Article 9 of its pacifist constitution, which bans the right of belligerency of the state. Japan's neighbors have also voiced displeasure at the legislation, and, predictably, China has warned Japan against militarization that it says could destabilize the region. It seems very likely that the legislation will be passed by the upper house this month, and, if it is, it will significantly change the dynamics of international relationships in the region.
2 Indian women have been sentenced to gang rape for a crime committed by their brother. They were sentenced by an illegal jury composed of upper caste males. The crime? Their brother, Ravi, had eloped with a higher caste woman. The 2 sisters are 23 and 15 years old. They have turned to India's Supreme Court for protection. They are afraid to return home. Amnesty International has issued a petition to save them from this punishment and has collected more than 200,000 signatures worldwide. The caste system is a prominent part of Indian culture. The 2 women are part of the lower caste, called untouchables. As such, they have little police protection. The story is being refuted by authorities.
According to the UN Development Agency, the Gaza Strip, ravaged by successive wars and nearly a decade of Israeli blockade, could become uninhabitable for residents within just 5 years. The social, health, and security-related ramifications of the high population density and overcrowding are among the factors that may render Gaza unlivable by 2020. Gaza, a tiny enclave of about 225 square miles squeezed between Israel, Egypt, and the Mediterranean Sea, is home to about 1.8 million Palestinians, making it one of the most densely populated territories in the world. While the high density is not new, the situation has been exacerbated by three Israeli military operations in the past 6 years and nearly a decade-long economic blockade. The blockade has ravaged the already debilitated infrastructure of Gaza, shattered its productive base, left no time for meaningful reconstruction or economic recovery, and impoverished the Palestinian population in Gaza. Even before last year's conflict, Gaza's electricity supply was not even enough to cover 40% of demand. 95% of water from coastal aquifers, the main source of fresh water, were considered unsafe to drink.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, September 1st, 2015. Settlers take over Palestinian homes in Jerusalem and heavy clashes with Israeli soldiers reported during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers continued on Tuesday at dawn their invasion into the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank and fired missiles into two homes before demolishing a store and several walls. The invasion into the camp started on Monday evening. Moreover, during the invasion, the soldiers kidnapped a former political prisoner, his mother, his son, and his brother. Eyewitnesses said that clashes took place between the soldiers and dozens of local youth who hurled stones and empty bottles at them, and the armed resistance fighters also exchanged fire with the invading forces. Sounds of loud explosions were heard in the area while military helicopters hovered overhead. The Israeli army said that one soldier suffered moderate to severe injury and was moved to Rambam Israeli Hospital in Haifa. In related news, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Tuesday at least 9 Palestinians in different districts of the occupied West Bank during various military invasions and searches of homes. Kidnappings and home searches were reported in Nablus, Hebron, and Ramallah cities. In Ramallah, clashes took place between the invading soldiers and local youth. No injuries were reported. Meanwhile, in Jericho City on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 4 Palestinians, including a father and his son, after invading the city and searching homes. In other news, Israeli soldiers accompanied a large group of Israeli settlers as they moved into a formerly Palestinian-owned building in the Silwan neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The arrival of the soldiers and the settlers in the neighborhood led to clashes with stone-throwing youth who were attacked by the soldiers. According to the Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan, the settlers claim to be part of the Atarit Kohanim organization, which is extreme right-wing colonial settler organization whose aim is to expel Palestinians from their lands in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and then take over the land for Jewish settlement only. The property occupied by the settlers on Tuesday is directly adjacent to one that was taken over by around 60 settlers 4 days ago. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, September 1st, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banmoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Asman, Connie Kazanowski, Doug McVeigh, Jared Dantzler, and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
I'm Jared Dantzler. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland moderates a live on-air debate on the proposed Nestle water bottling plant at the city of Cascade Locks between the city administration, which has pushed for the Nestle facility there, and two members of the local Water Alliance, which is opposed to it. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Doug McVeigh speaks with Molly Gill, Government Affairs Counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support and for supporting this beautiful community radio. If you're not a member, you can become one today by going to kboo.fm, kboo.fm, and click donate today.
And stay tuned now for the KBOO in-depth report from Doug McVeigh about the end of solitary confinement in California.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.